All right, let's dive right in. Today, we're going to explore the world of cloning and protein production. We've got some pretty dense material to work through, excerpts from a university-level microbiology course. So hopefully we can make some sense of it.
It's really quite amazing how scientists have learned to manipulate DNA and bacteria, turning them into, like, these tiny little factories that churn out specific proteins.
Tiny factories, huh?
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool way to think about it. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's just back up for a second and, you know, make sure we're all on the same page here. What exactly do we even mean when we say cloning in this context? I mean, we're not talking about, like, creating herds of identical sheep, are
we? No, definitely not. In molecular biology, when we talk about cloning, we're talking about taking a specific piece of DNA, kind of like a blueprint, if you will, and inserting it into a circular piece of DNA called a plasmid.
So plasmids are like what? These little, like, portable storage devices for genetic information that bacteria carry around.
Exactly. And what's really neat is that scientists can actually engineer these plasmids, we call them cloning vectors, to carry that extra genetic information, like the blueprints for those specific proteins we were talking about.
Okay, I'm starting to get the picture here. So if we're going to build our own cloning vector, what are the essential tools, the components that we're going to need?
Well, there are three key components that every cloning vector needs. The origin of replication, a selectable marker, and a multiple cloning site.
Okay, let's break those down one by one. The origin of replication, that one sounds, I don't know, kind of self-explanatory, right? It's like the starting point where the bacteria's machinery can grab onto the plasmid and start making copies, right?
Right, exactly. Without it, our plasmid wouldn't be replicated and we'd be stuck. Our protein production would just, like, grind to a halt.
Okay, makes sense. So then we've got the selectable marker. That's basically like a VIP pass, right?
Right.
Only the bacteria that has successfully picked up our engineered plasmid get to survive.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. The selectable marker is typically a gene that gives bacteria resistance to a specific antibiotic. So when we grow them on a petri dish with that antibiotic, only the bacteria carrying our plasmid with its special VIP pass will survive and multiply.
That's actually really clever, like a built-in quality control system.
Mm.
All right, so what about this multiple cloning site? That one sounds kind of like a construction zone to me.
It kind of is. It's a region in the plasmid that has all these specific recognition sites for different restriction enzymes.
Restriction enzymes, those are.
Oh, right. Restriction enzymes are like molecular scissors. They cut DNA at very specific sequences.
So it's like we've got these designated cutting and pasting zones within the plasmid.
Exactly. We use these molecular scissors to cut both the plasmid and the DNA sequence we want to insert. And then we use another enzyme called DNA ligase, which acts like molecular glue, to paste them together.
Molecular scissors and glue. I love it. Okay, but hold on a sec. If we're cutting and pasting DNA like that, don't we have to be really careful to make sure we're putting it in the right way? You know, like making sure we're not putting a puzzle piece in backward.
Absolutely, you're right. That's what we call controlling the directionality of the insert. And to do this, we use two different restriction enzymes that create different sticky ends.
Sticky ends. Okay, now you've got my attention.
So when those restriction enzymes, our molecular scissors, cut the DNA, they often leave these short, single-stranded overhangs. And these overhangs, or sticky ends, are complementary to each other, meaning they want to stick back together, kind of like Velcro. And by using two different enzymes, we can create unique sticky ends on the plasmid and our insert, ensuring that they can only be glued together in the correct orientation.
Wow, that's so cool. Science is amazing. All right, so now we've got our plasmids all prepped and ready to go. But how do we actually get those plasmids inside the bacteria? And how do we know if they've actually taken up the plasmid with our insert?
Well, there's a pretty cool technique called blue-white screening that uses, it's a visual thing. It relies on a gene that gets disrupted when our desired DNA is inserted into the plasmid. And bacteria with that disrupted gene, they'll produce white colonies on the petri dish, while those without the insert produce blue colonies.
So it's like we're searching for a needle in a haystack. But luckily, the needle happens to be white and the haystack is blue.
Exactly. It makes identifying those bacteria with our desired plasmid much easier.
Okay, so we've got our bacteria happily carrying our engineered plasmids. But how do we tell them to actually start making the protein we want?
That's where transcriptional regulation comes into play. It's basically about controlling which genes are turned on or off inside the bacteria. And bacteria, they've got these really neat systems called operons, which act like control panels for gene expression.
Operons, like tiny little command centers.
Yeah, think of it as a cluster of genes that all work together. and they're all controlled by a single promoter and operator. And this arrangement allows bacteria to really quickly turn on or off a whole set of genes at once, depending on, you know, what's going on in their environment.
That sounds incredibly efficient. Can you give us an example of how this works in practice?
Sure. One of the classic examples is the lac operon, which is all about lactose metabolism in E. coli.
So the lac operon, that's inducible,
right?
Meaning it can be turned on.
Exactly. When lactose is present, it binds to a repressor protein, which is kind of like a bouncer blocking the door to the operon. But when lactose binds, it essentially kicks that bouncer out of the way, and that allows the genes involved in lactose breakdown to be turned on.
So the presence of lactose basically flips the switch, and the bacteria start making the machinery they need to digest it. That's pretty smart. Are there operons that work, like, in the opposite way?
Absolutely. The trypteronon is a repressible operon that controls the synthesis of the amino acid tryptophan.
Repressible meaning it can be switched off?
Yep. When tryptophan levels are high, it actually binds to a repressor protein. And this complex then blocks the operon, turning off the genes involved in making more tryptophan.
Oh, so it's like a feedback loop. When there's enough tryptophan, the cell just shuts down its own production line. Super efficient.
Exactly. And, you know, the really cool thing is that scientists have figured out how to kind of hijack these natural control systems to produce the proteins they're interested in.
Wait, so we can actually trick the bacteria into working for us? This is getting really interesting.
That's right. They've developed these specialized plasmids called expression vectors, which are specifically designed for protein production. And these vectors, they've got promoters, operators, and they often use that lac operon system we were just talking about to really tightly control when and how much protein the bacteria produce.
So we're essentially giving the bacteria a set of instructions on how to build our protein of choice, right? But how do we actually kickstart the production process?
By adding a molecule that mimics lactose, like IPTG, it's like waving a fake VIP pass at that bouncer, tricking the bacteria into thinking there's lactose present, even when there isn't.
Oh, sneaky. And there's a particular strain of E. coli that's kind of like the superstar when it comes to protein production, right?
Yeah, you're talking about BL21DE3. This strain has been engineered to be even more efficient at protein production, and it does this by incorporating a gene for T7 RNA polymerase. It's like giving them a specialized team of construction workers that can quickly and accurately follow the blueprints from our expression vector.
Okay, so I think I'm starting to see how all of these pieces fit together.
To understand this better, let's take a look at a plasmid map of PET28A, which is a very commonly used expression vector.
Plasmid maps. They always remind me of those super intricate subway maps, but for DNA. All right, I'm ready to navigate this genetic subway system.
We won't go into every single detail, but let's just focus on a few key landmarks. First, we've got the selectable marker, which is usually an antibiotic resistance gene, like CanaR for kanamycin resistance. This is how we ensure that only the bacteria carrying our plasmid will survive.
Got it. So that's like our you must have this ticket to ride situation. What else is on our map?
Right next to it is the multiple cloning site, which is where our gene of interest is inserted. And it's strategically positioned right under the control of the T7 promoter.
The T7 promoter, that's where our specialized construction crew, the T7 RNA polymerase, comes in and starts reading the blueprints for our protein, right?
You got it. And to make our lives easier later on, there's often what we call a HIS tag, which is basically a sequence of 6 histidine amino acids that we add to the protein.
HIS tag. What's so special about that?
Think of it like a molecular handle that we can use to easily grab our protein during purification. Histidine has this really strong affinity for nickel ions, so we can use a special resin with nickel to capture our HIS tagged protein.
Like a molecular fishing hook. That's brilliant. Okay, so we've tricked the bacteria into making our protein. We've got our handy-dandy HIS tag. What happens next? How do we get that protein out of those bacteria?
That's the next step, protein extraction. First, we need to break open the bacterial cells, which is called lysis.
Okay, that sounds a little violent. How do we do that without destroying our precious protein?
Well, there are a few different methods. One is using detergents, which work kind of like dish soap, dissolving the bacterial membranes. Another method is sonication, which uses high-frequency sound waves to basically shake the cells apart. And we can also use freeze-thaw cycles, where the formation of ice crystals during freezing helps to crack open the cells.
Wow, so many options. So once the cells are deutilized, what happens to our protein?
Well, now it's just kind of floating around in this mixture of all sorts of other cellular components. And we need to protect it from being degraded by the bacteria's own proteases, which are basically enzymes that break down proteins. We do that by adding protease inhibitors to our lysis buffer.
Protease inhibitors. Those are like little bodyguards for our protein. Makes sense. But how do we actually separate our protein from all that other cellular stuff?
That's where chromatography comes in. It's a really powerful technique for separating different components of a mixture.
Chromatography, that sounds like something to do with colors.
Well, it's not quite as visually stunning as a rainbow, but it's equally impressive in its own way. Chromatography techniques basically exploit different properties of proteins to separate them. It's like a molecular sorting hat, helping us isolate our desired protein.
That's what I call a deep dive. We've gone from cloning basics to molecular scissors and glue to tricking bacteria and using molecular fishing hooks. I can't wait to find out more about those chromatography techniques.
Me too. Next time, we'll delve deeper into the world of protein purification and see how scientists use these techniques to isolate and study those proteins that are essential for life. Welcome back. Pretty amazing how scientists have taken these natural processes in bacteria and kind of engineered them for their own purposes, huh?
Yeah, it really is. It's like they've cracked the code of life and, you know, learned to speak the bacteria's language. But this isn't just about like scientific curiosity, is it? What are some of the like the real world applications of this technology? Why should our listeners care about all of this?
Well, just think about insulin for people with diabetes. It used to be extracted from animal tankreases, but now it's largely produced using these tiny bacterial factories we've been talking about.
Wow, so millions of people rely on these tiny factories every day. That's incredible. Sure. And that's just one example, right?
Oh, absolutely. Recombinant proteins, those are the proteins produced using this technology. They're everywhere. They're used in like industrial processes and laundry detergents and food production, and they're essential for developing new therapies for all sorts of diseases, you know, cancer, autoimmune disorders, you name it.
It's kind of mind-blowing to think that we can harness the power of bacteria to like create life-saving medicines and solve real-world problems. It's like something out of science fiction.
It really is. And honestly, we've only just scratched the surface of what's possible with this technology. But let's get back to the nuts and bolts of protein production for a minute. You mentioned something earlier called blunt end ligation. How does that differ from using those sticky ends we talked about?
Oh, right. Blunt end ligation. So if sticky ends are like puzzle pieces fitting together, are blunt ends just like flat edges?
Exactly. Some restriction enzymes just cut straight through the DNA, leaving no overhangs. Those are blunt ends. And you can still ligate them together, you know, glue them, but it's not as efficient because there's no natural attraction between the ends.
So using two different restriction enzymes to create sticky ends is like adding a bit of molecular magnetism to make sure everything connects perfectly.
Precisely. It makes for a much more precise and efficient connection. And that's super important when you're working with something as tiny and delicate as DNA.
Okay, that makes sense. You also mentioned that sometimes researchers need to concentrate the protein solution after they've extracted it from the bacteria.
Yeah.
How do they do that? Is it like squeezing out the excess water from a sponge?
It's a bit more sophisticated than that. We use a technique called diafiltration, which uses these centrifugal filters. Imagine them like tiny sieves.
Okay, I'm picturing a tiny sieve. What happens next?
Well, you put your protein solution into the filter unit and spin it in a centrifuge. And the filter membrane has a specific molecular weight cutoff, so it allows smaller molecules like water and salts to pass through, but it retains those larger protein molecules.
So it's like a high-tech spin cycle, removing the excess liquid and leaving you with a more concentrated protein solution.
Exactly. And you can use this technique not only to concentrate the protein, but also to exchange buffers.
Buffer exchange. Why would we need to do that?
Remember how we were talking about proteins being a bit sensitive? Well, the buffer is like the perfect spa treatment for your protein. It helps maintain the right pH and ionic strength to keep it happy and stable.
So it's like giving the protein a relaxing bath to keep it in tip-top shape.
Precisely. And sometimes we need to change the buffer for a specific experiment or application. And diafiltration allows us to do that gently without stressing the protein too much.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. It's all starting to sound like a very delicate dance, you know, carefully manipulating these molecules at every step.
It is. And that brings us to the next stage, chromatography. We touched on the three main types earlier, affinity, size exclusion, and ion exchange. ready to explore these molecular sorting hats in more detail.
Absolutely. Let's start with affinity chromatography. We already talked about using the His tag and nickel resin, kind of like a molecular fishing hook.
Right. But there's another approach using what's called a fusion protein. It's like giving our protein of interest a special tag that makes it stick to a specific resin.
So we're attaching our protein to something that it naturally wants to bind to.
Exactly. For example, you could fuse your protein to maltose binding protein, or MBP, which binds really tightly to amylose resin. So you load your protein mixture onto the column, wash away all the other stuff that doesn't bind, and then you can detach your protein from the MBP, leaving you with just your purified protein.
That's pretty clever. So what about size exclusion chromatography? How does that one work?
Imagine a column filled with porous beads, you know, beads with little holes in them of a specific size range. Larger proteins will flow through the column faster because they can't fit into the pores, while smaller proteins will get kind of trapped in those pores and take longer to come out. We call that eluding.
It's like an obstacle course where the larger proteins can sprint right through, but the smaller proteins have to navigate a more complicated path.
Great analogy. Now, for ion exchange chromatography, this technique relies on the fact that proteins have different charges.
So opposites attract. Positively charged proteins sticking to negatively charged beads, and vice versa.
You got it. By using a column packed with beads that have either a positive or a negative charge, we can selectively capture proteins based on their charge. And then by gradually increasing the salt concentration in the buffer, we can release those bound proteins, separating them based on their subtle charge differences.
So we've got affinity chromatography for specific binding, size exclusion for separating by size, and ion exchange for separating by charge. It's like having a whole toolkit of molecular sorting techniques at our disposal.
Exactly. And oftentimes, researchers will use a combination of these techniques in sequence to achieve a higher level of purity. It's like a multi-step purification process, carefully refining the protein mixture until you have your target protein all by itself.
Wow. It's just amazing how much precision and ingenuity goes into isolating and purifying these tiny but incredibly important molecules.
It is, and it really is a testament to the power of modern molecular biology techniques. But before we wrap things up, let's zoom out for a moment and talk about the bigger picture.
Okay, zooming out, what's the one key takeaway you want our listeners to walk away with today?
I want them to appreciate the incredible potential of this technology, the ability to manipulate DNA and engineer bacteria to produce specific proteins. It's a game changer. It's revolutionized medicine, industry, and our understanding of life itself.
That's a powerful thought.
It is. But it's also important to remember that, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. As we continue to unlock the secrets of life and develop even more sophisticated biotechnologies, we need to be mindful of the ethical implications and make sure that these advancements benefit all of humanity.
Yeah, it's really it really makes you think we've come a long way from just understanding the basics of DNA to actually being able to manipulate it and even engineer bacteria to produce, like, you know, custom-made proteins. It's like we've become, I don't know, molecular architects or something.
And the applications, like we said, are just remarkable. From those life-saving medicines to all those innovative industrial processes, it's really changing the world around us, this technology.
But, like you said earlier, with great power comes great responsibility. What are some of the ethical things we need to think about, the considerations as we move forward into this kind of uncharted territory?
Well, one of the big ones is the possibility of unintended consequences. You know, when you start messing with complex biological systems, you don't always know what's going to happen. It's like, you know, like throwing a stone in a pond. Those ripples can spread pretty far.
Right. So we got to be careful. Proceed with caution and a little bit of humility, right? We don't want to mess up the balance of nature.
Exactly. And then there's the issue of, you know, access and equity. These really cutting edge technologies are often expensive, resource intensive. We need to make sure the benefits of these advancements are available to everyone, not just, you know, a select few.
That's a good point. We don't want to make existing inequalities worse. It's about making sure scientific progress benefits everybody.
Absolutely. And of course, there's always that worry about, you know, misuse. Like, yeah, any powerful technology, this could be used for harmful purposes. If it falls into the wrong hands.
That's a scary thought. It really highlights the need for responsible innovation, ethical guidelines.
Couldn't agree more. Open dialogue, transparency, and thoughtful regulation, those are all essential to make sure these incredible advances are used for good.
Well said. This deep dive has been really fascinating. We've explored, the world of cloning and protein production, from the basic building blocks of DNA to all these sophisticated techniques used to isolate and purify those essential molecules. And we even touched on the ethical implications of this really revolutionary technology.
It's been a pleasure sharing this journey, with you and our listeners. It's a rapidly changing field full of possibilities and challenges, both.
So as we wrap up our deep dive, what's that one message, that one takeaway you'd like our listeners to remember?
I want them to remember this, that the ability to manipulate DNA and engineer bacteria to produce these, these specific proteins is a testament to, to human ingenuity and our understanding of, how life works. It's a powerful tool with the potential to really solve some of the world's most pressing problems. But it's crucial that we use this knowledge wisely with careful consideration of the ethical implications and a commitment to ensuring, equal access to the benefits of these advancements.
Well put. I think our listeners are now well-equipped to navigate this complex and exciting world of molecular biology.
Who knows? Maybe they'll even be inspired to, to join the ranks of scientists pushing the boundaries in this incredible field.
That's a wrap on our deep dive into cloning and protein production. Until next time, stay curious and keep exploring.